welcome back, and thank you for tuning in today. If you are joining us for the first time, it's good to have you with us. I'm glad you found the program. I'm your host, Henrik Palmgren from Sweden, Scandinavia. And this is Red Eyes Radio, a program that questions the established so-called wisdom and puts the lies that exuberates from the educational system, news media, and entertainment in perspective. We offer analysis and a different view, and this usually presents itself once you take such things as an accurate history, reality, and nature in context. We seek to offer a more balanced picture of the world than the agenda-driven and hysterical mainstream press does. On redicecreations.com, you can find much more of the subjects that we hope will make you think, question, and hopefully learn something new about pertaining to our world and those who are seeking to control us. Daryl Hamamoto is a professor of Asian American Studies at the University of California, Davis. He is a recognized authority on U.S. popular culture and mass media, having written extensively in the field, including Nervous Laughter, Television-Situated Comedy, and Liberal Democratic Ideology, and also Monitored Peril, Asian Americans and the Politics of TV Representation. The forthcoming book, Servitors of Empire, Studies in the Dark Side of Asian America, confounds the conventional academic wisdom concerning race, ethnicity, and social class in contemporary U.S. politics, culture, and society. Professor Hamamoto is also currently writing a handbook directed to college and university-age youth disillusioned with academic orthodoxy and political correctness titled New World Order Theory for Students. This is what we're going to talk about today. Daryl, hi, and welcome. Thank you for coming on the program. Nice to speak with you today.
Thanks so much. I'm glad to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
You bet. You wrote me an email a little bit while back. We started talking about your book, Servitors of Empire. Very, very interesting read. I've been enjoying it in the last few days here, the last week, really. And why don't you tell us first how you set out to write, I guess, one book and how the nature of the book kind of changed as you got deeper and deeper into the research. How long did it take you to write this book?
Well, the genesis of this book began in 2005 after I came back from sabbatical from Okinawa. And originally it was going to be just about criminality. And in doing more reading, more background work, I discovered that Asian Americans were now, at this point in time, visible at the highest reaches of the criminal networks. So I had to rethink the project. And the result is what you see here.
Tell us a little bit more about that and what the outset, how that differed. I mean, obviously the subtitle is Studies in the Dark Side of Asian America. And what is the main kind of outline that you propose in the book and talk about?
Well, in my particular field, Asian American Studies, which is a branch of the ethnic studies research boom that took hold in academia beginning in the late 1960s, the dominant thrust of the research is Asian Americans as historical victims. That's true. Exploitation, exclusion, even internment is part of our history. But this is a model that's about 30 or 40 years out of date, I felt. And because of the recent, let's say, 1965, post-1965 generation, we have seen a radically different type of Asian immigrant cohort arrive in the United States. These are people that I would prefer to call elite transnationals. And these individuals, as it turns out, have been cropping up in finance, like Neil Kashkari, Vikram Pandit. A lot of them come from India. Many of them have PhDs in physics, not in finance. And they were seen as really valuable assets for the finance community, with coming up with their really sophisticated and comprehensible financial models to sell to the gullible institutions like the University of California, as well as ordinary investors. And the sciences in particular, from physics to the biosciences to medicine, Asian intellectual labor in specific was recruited first from Taiwan and then more recently from from China and India in order to staff the research and development at the most sophisticated levels, from cancer research to genomics, you name it, crop science, animal science, and all the way down the line. You also see some influence in the area of arts and letters, but I focused primarily on the sciences and business and the economy and politics as well.
Yeah, definitely. It's a very interesting read. There's a lot of things, of course. I guess yourself went through a kind of a change, as the main outline of the book was to kind of study, the victimization to a certain extent. And then the longer and deeper into the research you got, you realize that there is another layer to this kind of story. And this has a lot to do with the geopolitical, conspiracies that we discuss on this program, the whole model of the New World Order, really, and how you kind of found in the book there is a specific class that are then to become the servitors of this very system. Maybe you can describe that a little bit more.
Certainly, that's an excellent summary of my objectives and the evolution and thought that I had to go through. And in that sense, it was a really fulfilling project, because the conclusions were unexpected. They were quite refreshing to me. And as a result, it's going to take a while before these insights, I think, begin to take hold within my field, amongst my colleagues, and perhaps even within the larger academic community. But the genesis occurred, I think, after 9/11 for me. I began to note that there were certain prominent Asian Americans that were put forth as part of the official government narrative that was put out there. Most notably, Norman Mineta, who was formerly the mayor of San Jose, California, and he had been in place as the U.S. Secretary of Transportation, conveniently just at the time when these concerted attacks occurred in the U.S. homeland. So that began to raise suspicions about his involvement, and as I devote an entire chapter to Norman Mineta, in this book, Servitors of Empire, to show how he was used as a former internee in a concentration camp for Japanese Americans who were placed in there at the outbreak of World War II. And he was there at the very moment to reassure a panicked public, especially those of Muslim religion or Arab Americans, that there would be no mass roundups and everything was going to be okay. I just thought that was too much of a convenient coincidence.
Yeah.
And I began to look also at the financial collapse, the financial crash, and began to, in essence, relearn everything that I thought I knew. So this project was very much a going back to graduate school and relearning from the ground up. And again, I was able to see any number of prominent Asian American people whose names kept on cropping up. Prior to that, in the mid-90s, there was in the U.S. What was called Chinagate, after Watergate, and that was also known as the Asian campaign scandal, when a number of foreign Asian nationals and Asian Americans' names surfaced in connection with U.S. congressional investigations. There was a good deal of reportage. And my default position originally was to defend these people that were being accused, because Asians in America, Asian Americans, have periodically been targeted for these types of political persecution campaigns. So I was initially defensive of this cohort. But the more I read and books came out, articles, journal pieces came out, and I had to make a significant turnabout. I felt that indeed the American political system had been radically compromised by foreign nationals. And since that time, we see, of course, that China, the People's Republic of China, its economy has eclipsed and integrated itself with the U.S. national economy. And really what was going on in the 90s was a bellwether event that was really a pointer to what's going on now, which is the absorption of the United States national economy, thanks to, I guess you could call them traitors within the U.S. Republic, including Asian Americans, by the way, people who are U.S. citizens who have sold out to these interests so that the U.S. economy can be brought low, just like other national economies have been brought low for the past few decades, thanks to certain groups' interests that I was introduced to when I started delving into the particulars of what is now called the New World Order system. So I have I developed in parallel with this book a theoretical and conceptual framework that I call New World Order Theory. Part of the plan for this book is to bring that knowledge base, that history of the New World Order system, into mainstream academia, because part of the problem that I suffered from, I suffered from what they call in forensic murder analysis, I suffered from linkage blindness. In the academic world, we were led astray for decades by a very well-funded, and someone should do a forensic analysis of the sources of the funds and the money that were going into it. We were led astray by 30, 40 years of so-called theory with a capital T. These were importations from France and to a certain extent Britain under the guise of deconstruction and structuralism, post-structuralism, and later forms of I'm being ironic here, deep thought that that blinded us to the deeper sources of conflict and problems that we were being faced with. So I had to completely retool in that area as well. So I have a number of agendas that I'm trying to execute simultaneously by specifically focusing on Asian Americans as a case study. Now, another rail in this attempt of mine is also to radically question the role of current contemporary race and ethnicity theory, which is, again one of these movements that started out well, and I think they were justified given the fact that the realities of racial and ethnic discrimination are real, have been real, and currently are real in the United States, but were hijacked in order to bring someone like a Barry Sotoro or a Barack Obama, who ostensibly is non-white, which paralyzed, it froze the body politic because he was a the messiah of the multicultural society, I guess. And and I'm getting slightly ahead of myself. And the next movement here is going to be the use of the GLBT, which is gay, lesbian, transgender agenda. They're going to use they're starting to use it right now, as I'll get into later, the GLBT agenda to freeze us and paralyze when they start using this particular cohort as a political wedge against the rest of America. And we're going to be afraid, we're going to be intimidated from criticizing these people, from Hillary Clinton, who is a presidential wannabe of longstanding status, to the new president of the University of California, Janet Napolitano, who left the U.S. Justice Department under cloudy circumstances of sexual harassment against men that worked under her,
yeah,
and her cohorts. They're going to use this as a political wedge, because if we criticize them, then just as in the case of Barry Sotoro or whatever his true name and identity might be, they're going to use the charge of homophobia to paralyze us and to squelch any sort of dissent. And I would want to counsel your subscribers, your listeners, against this tactic that is being held in the wings for us as we move deeper and deeper into the system. It's a 1-2 punch. First was race, now comes gender.
Well, this is a very important issue, I feel, as well, this political wedge and how this is being used. And we need to, you know, discuss this more in detail, kind of go into the mechanics of this, how this is going to be used. And we'll get deeper into this as we talk more about the main, you know, outline of your book here. But again, okay, you basically set out to prove the victimization of Asians in America, right? And although that you found, as you said, a reality of this in the beginning of 1900s, I guess, so going upward. But something happened at some point there, and I kind of want to get into a little bit of the mechanics of the timeline, if you will, of being moving from a persecution of sorts, then, if we can call it that, a non-admittance, I guess, into society, and ending up at the higher levels of the structure that we can see, the political structure that we can see, not only in America, but in the world today as well. How would you explain that this happened?
Certainly, that's an excellent question. I believe, and I think adequate substantial documentation to validate my point. I think the immigration officials and the corporate chieftains and the military and the top-level decision makers took inspiration from an earlier success story, and I mean that ironically, success, earlier success story in Operation Paperclip, where large numbers of either Nazi Party members or Nazi-affiliated scientists and engineers were successfully exfiltrated from Greater Germany into the United States and went to work. Most of your listeners know this story already, but went to work at the highest levels of not just space and aeronautics, but also biological research as well. That's called Operation Paperclip. Similarly, this is the historical demarcation point that I think you're asking for. Similarly, the top level, the echelon of the government, military, and corporate chieftains said, hey, this is a really good formula. We need more intellectual brain power. Because at the same time, the departments of education and so forth, Charlotte Isserby has written extensively about this, was in the process of dumbing down and defunding public education to the point where we're at now in the United States in 2014. So they turned to, they meaning the top level decision makers, turned to U.S. client states in Asia for intellectual labor. And the first country for that purpose was Taiwan, which at that point enjoyed the military and financial support of the United States against the People's Republic of China. So the immigration laws that had kept out Asian immigrants, specifically by race, specifically since 1924, were revised in 1965, and President Lyndon Baines Johnson, using as a backdrop the Statue of Liberty in New York Harbor, signed the Immigration Act of 1965, raising the barrier for immigration of select Asian professionals, and these were people that were from the sciences and engineering. And that, in 1965, began to feed into what is today the success of either Route 128 outside of Boston, the Harvard-MIT corridor, that tech corridor, and even more importantly, what is today known as Silicon Valley in San Jose area, which you'll be visiting very soon at the end of June.
That's right.
I hope to shake your hand and meet you in person.
Oh, definitely. Yeah, of course. That's going to be a great conference, I think, by the way. But exactly. So let's just detail that a little bit more. This 1965, the Immigration Act, the way this was changed. I mean, this is in many people's heads a perception that finally we're moving in the right direction, right? But what you're saying is that this was part of an initial step towards a process. This was a theatrical ploy, maybe, of sorts, and the reasoning for this was, of course, to create the system that we today can see in place, I reckon. Can you explain that a little bit more to us?
Exactly. There was a theatrical element to it, saying, yes, okay, we're going through this torturous civil rights period here. 1965 was the height of it, and so we're going to open our doors to people who are excluded. This is also a way, by the way, to neutralize, not completely, but at least to kind of neutralize criticism by civil rights leaders, including those from the Asian American community, about the exclusionary policy. So that was the theatrical part of it. That was the window dressing. But the material reasons for the Immigration Act, which I'm pointing out, is not to provide opportunities for people who want to come to America and explore freedom, you know, from oppression, from their home countries.
Sure, yeah.
But really to contribute to this huge surge in scientific and technological engineering that we're seeing today, which is now being used to enslave us rather than to liberate us. These are all technologies that were supposed to make life easier for us, protect us, to provide more agriculture productivity, enhance communication and whatnot. Some of it has come true. We're speaking through Skype technology, which is part of that. But then there's the what I call the weaponized dimension of these technologies that were being brought in at the same time. And that was part of the plan. Coincidentally, by the way, Norman Mineta was mayor of San Jose, which is the heart of Silicon Valley, during that peak time. So I don't think it's a coincidence that he was brought forward from this moment in history to the events of 9/11.
Exactly. So not only, I mean, in a way here, you're also speaking about racial differences here, also very much going against the grain, of course. You're using the general IQ, I guess, of the Asian community and the adherence to technology and everything else to kind of build a system. So you're also talking about the control structure of the New World Order, right? The technology, the surveillance and everything that we see today, and that this was somehow enabled with the aid of the Asian community, correct?
Very much so. And of course, at the individual and personal level, these immigrants, and I'm not faulting them for this, see this as sheer opportunity for themselves, for their families. If they're coming from a small island country like Taiwan, given the level of competition and limited seats in the elite institutions and the lack of opportunities in the industry there, the United States, Silicon Valley, became a very attractive destination. The same holds true with a later cohort that followed on the heels of the Taiwanese scientists and engineers. By the way, Wenho Li at Los Alamos Nuclear Labs is part of the Taiwanese-American scientist-engineer cohort. It's just one prominent example. But following on the heels of that were large numbers of scientists and engineers coming from India, top-level graduates of the India Institute of Technology, which, by the way, was funded to a large extent by IT persons in Silicon Valley to create that intellectual workforce before they even emigrated, with the idea that they would be bringing them in to the United States to benefit from their vast intellectual power and training, also to discipline existing native-born scientists and engineers in the United States. And that model is being advanced today in 2014. Google has a barge sitting right now in San Francisco Bay, and top-level globalists who run Facebook and Google and Microsoft, Bill Gates and his cohorts, in other words, are militating aggressively for increased immigration levels of intellectual workers from overseas. So the earlier cohort of Asian immigrant scientists and engineers now are also having a wedge driven against them. So it's an ongoing process here. And eventually, I think if Ray Kurzweil has his way, all of these highly trained, well-compensated professionals will be rendered irrelevant once artificial intelligence and self-teaching computers are put into play. But they're building, in other words, the infrastructure for their own demise. This is the process of advanced globalist
exactly.
Corporatism. Yes.
See, that's a very interesting point there as well of just using who you can at what what point in time basically to advance your agenda. So there's a couple of examples there, I guess we could talk a little bit more about. For example, I think you detail in the book Dr. Wenho Li, I think he was working at the Los Alamos National Laboratory, and he ended up basically giving information to China, right? Correct?
Correct. Again, that was another case where my default position was to defend the accused individuals, whether it's Wenho Li. There is a number of lesser names that were involved who are of Chinese origins, who are naturalized U.S. citizens. And my default position was to defend and protect their reputations and that of the larger community. But the more I read, the more I investigated, the more books that came out in the wake of these scandals, I would, you know, I was forced to admit to myself that indeed Asian Americans, Asians of U.S. citizenship, had either wittingly or unwittingly had transferred crucial technologies to China. Now, the problem didn't rest there. They were tools, they were servitors, they were conduits for a large, higher level plans on the part of the same people who were responsible for Operation Paperclip, I guess, or what I call Operation Rice Paperclip. but they had planned to transfer technology to China, just as they had planned to transfer the manufacturing base to China to route out what remained of American productivity and wealth, especially that of the storied American middle class. So that was a top level decision. Wen Ho Li, and I'm not saying that he's off the hook on this, but he was a tool. He was a diversion from larger plans to transfer massive deep technologies to the people of China.
So how do we explain, I guess, national allegiance in all of this? There's obviously, as we've discussed many times in the program, this kind of supranational agenda basically going on, where people and corporations, etc., are no longer tied to nationality per se. But in certain cases of these instances, for example, we might have people coming into the U.S., maybe Europe, other countries that do still have an allegiance with their former country, but they end up working for a different country and then are willing to kind of give out information, as we could see with Ho Li in that case. But at the same time, the people are being converted, I guess, into just a higher agenda on top of it, right? So I think you write in the book, the essays in the book intend to point out the centrality of race and ethnicity in the engineering of the post-modern techno-fascist world order. So what role does race play in all of this at the same time as we are kind of trying to deny that it exists as a factor, at least on the politically correct, educational media level on this?
Okay, it operates on two levels. At the grassroots level, let's say in the case of Wen Hu Li, I'm just using him as an example of many, many other Chinese American or Asian American scientists, engineers who have found themselves in similar predicaments. There is a great source of national pride from their home country. It's a residue of their cultural origins, the common language, family connections, and just the idea that they're making good in America, and as a consequence, making countries like Taiwan look good as a consequence. So that form of what might be called ethno-nationalism is exploited by not only China, but also in the case of the United States. So I would have to say that I'm partly complicit, since I'm in Asian American studies, in advancing these notions, which are good in and of themselves. They're innocuous, they're harmless. It's great to be, to be proud to be Swedish or Japanese or Canadian.
Exactly, of course.
That's fine. Yeah. But as I said, getting back to an earlier insight that I had, the social engineers and the mind managers, very smart PhD type people at the high levels of planning, they figured out how to weaponize this sort of ethnic and national pride, and they were able to exploit it and use it against the not just the American people, but the people of the world. And at the highest levels, of course, and you've covered this on your program in many different settings or contexts, there's a high-level individuals that don't really think in terms of national boundaries or national sovereignty. These are the one-worlders. These are the New World Order. There's any number of ways to characterize their dream of a unified global empire with different groups that can be allowed their little different language groups and even their own regional currencies. But all of it at bottom will be theirs. So it's operating on this twin level here. And most people at the grassroots level, the ground level, or even my colleagues are still locked into this ethno-nationalist level of understanding. And that's why New World Order theory is really an important corrective to this really limited form of understanding the larger political economic system.
Exactly. And you mentioned before as well here that you were going to seek to try to bring this very idea, the theory of the New World Order into the academic circles, and that has to be, I mean, that has to be something which is going to be very difficult in itself. And I'm not saying it's not going to be a success or whatnot, but due to the level of the nature of the things that you discuss and the academic world that you are coming up against, that might not be so easy, right?
Certainly. If you looked in the dictionary under the entry futility, you'll see my picture there. This is what I do for, you know, this is part of me. I'm a champion of lost causes. And so far, I'm the only person who subscribes to New World Order Theory in academia that I know of is myself. Toward that end, my next book is going to be a scaled down version of this. And it's going to be directed to young people, particularly those of college and university age. And it's going to be called New World Order Theory for Students. And it's going to take from the humanities to the sciences, one by one, just talk about how these different disciplines are used not for the advancement of civilization and technological knowledge, which is in itself fine. I mean, that represents all that's great about humanity, but is being used to enslave them. And I think I have a really willing and receptive audience based on my own students here and my conversations with young people, college-age, university-age students all over the place. I've been in touch with them because they are faced with a future with no jobs. And I'm talking about people with university degrees, people with four-year degrees, master's degrees, even PhDs, know that their future has been taken away from them, and they want to understand why. And this is, I think, one of the reasons for the proliferation of alternative media, such as your fine program. There are many of them in the United States, and I'm sure in other languages that I don't have access to. I'm sure there are all kinds of questions being raised by university and college-age people all over the world. So I'm going to go around to my colleagues who are numbskulls, to put it. they're invested in their own work, of course, right? They're not going to retool. They're not going to change course. So this is how they made their reputations. They're going to stick with the story, even if it's a false story. So I'm going to go around them. I'm going to take my program directly to the people who are most invested in what's going on now and what's going on in the future. That's young people, student, college, and university, and even high school students.
Well, that's great. Definitely. Let's give out some more details about that later on and when that's out due. But so do you feel that nationalities, certain races, then to that degree, is being used and duped by the notion that they are victimized, partially, of course, because this is based on a past reality, perhaps, but they also manage to gather a momentum and maybe possibly even a fervor in the context of that victimization. And therefore, they are efficient tools to kind of further the advancement of the agenda that we're talking about here.
That's exactly it. It did have a basis in historical reality and historical experience, but even within my field, Asian American studies, and these are anomalies that I begin to ask, you know, seriously question, what kind of field am I in, Asian American studies?
Right. Yeah.
But I started to see elite transnationals showing up here. We had this one woman who's like the daughter of a Singaporean ambassador. We had this one guy, and they're ostensibly Asian American. One fellow who confessed to me personally, I guess he was feeling guilty, that he's, you know, they're originally from the Philippines. His father was working for the World Bank. And here they are, raging race, as they say at UC Berkeley, and exploiting historical hardships of, you know, actually existing hardships of people of generations ago. And they're still really working that line hard. And the university is going with it. They're promoting it. They're promoting, and by the way, the same process is going on within African American studies and Latina studies. You have elite transnational showing up in these disciplines as well. So I might be turning in my ethnic racial minority ID card pretty soon, drawing from their little fraternity. But this is a process that the educational establishment has glommed onto. They see this as an effective tool of control, because all they have to do is run Asian Pacific Culture Month or Latina Culture Month or start a holiday for somebody, and they can just keep playing the ethno-nationalism card, and nothing's going to change. And it also has the other advantage for the establishment by keeping us locked into our own little ethno-nationalist compartments. And we can no longer really live in a truly plural society, which is, you know, in itself good. It's healthy. It's wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Now, let's talk a little bit about some of the people you have on the cover then, per se. Maybe we can just run through, I guess, some of the higher names, and you've primarily focused, I guess, on the U.S. political system, but there are a number of people in there. And is there a certain aspect, would you say, as well, of a trait that is common within the Asian American community of being willing to kind of partake in this, but not maybe speak up? Is there a, I guess what I'm asking, is there a general obedience trait within the Asian nationality?
It's a universal human trait. I guess Nietzsche called it the will to power.
Yeah.
It so happens that Asian Americans have been earmarked, as I mentioned earlier, they've been targeted or slated for this intermediary position that I call servitor. And most people are not going to look at the larger implications of their actions. I'm sure Dr. Stephen Chu, who's at the far left hand top of the of these little thumbnail pictures up there on the cover, she's a Nobel Prize winner. I'm sure when he started out as a young PhD student, he just wanted to be the best scientist that he could be. But now he's the U.S. Secretary of Energy. He was in place when the Gulf oil disaster took unfolded and thousands of lives were ruined as a result in sea life. And he was also the chief negotiator at the University of California, which was his home institution before he went into the government. And I'm sure he's going to have a really nice, cushy job after he leaves government service. But he was at the University of California. He was one of the chief negotiators for BP, which is once was known as British Petroleum, taking over a lot of the research and publicly funded infrastructure of the University of California. And I'm sure he's going to be very, very, very well rewarded for that purpose. So I think so far as any cultural traits are concerned, he's like anybody else. He has an opportunity. He's going to seize it, and he's going to play it for all it's worth. And until he's no longer useful for these people.
Yeah, yeah. And also, as you emphasized before, that this is also about the opportunity of turning this around so that, for example, I guess in the case of Obama or some of the other people out there, that it's being, if you end up in a position where you cannot criticize these people because they can race, you know, they bring out the race card and it's a convenient measure of shutting down critique. Let's talk about that a little bit and how that's being used.
Yes, as I alluded to earlier, any of these individuals are Asian American, and I think a good portion of the American public now have been educated to certain aspects of Asian American history and the great civil rights violations that have been visited upon different groups within that category, and that quelches dissent. It's, you know, as I stated earlier, my own default position was to defend these individuals until I really started looking into the deeper levels of control that they were being manipulated by. Now, if I may offer one other dimension that, let's say, other ethnic groups do not suffer from in the United States, and that is that most of these people that we're talking about are immigrants. And if I may generalize, I think part of the immigrant psychology is to get over and succeed by any means possible and to make yourself, your group, your family, and your home country proud of you all the way down the line.
Sure, yeah.
There's also a sort of a nationalistic, patriotic dimension of that. I call it the gratitude factor. I think in their heart of hearts, a lot of these people think that they are giving back or contributing to the American Republic, even though they are destroying it, not just from the standpoint of the technology, but the civil liberties. One of the people that are illustrated on the cover is John Chun Yu. He's an immigrant from South Korea, a very important American military corporate client state since the Cold War, product of elite education, Yale University, and he teaches at Bolt Hall at the University of California. By the way, his offices are picketed daily at the University of California. And I learned from a friend of mine who works for the federal government in San Francisco, who's an attorney, that John Chun Yu's courses at the University of California Law School, Bolt Hall, the locations are not published.
Hmm.
They're moved from place to place so that they'll avoid picketing or any sort of untoward confrontations. So this is a warning to any of the young people that are listening here, is that if you do bad, there's going to be repercussions. You're not going to be able to get away with these devious types of acts, to put them lightly. And then you have next to him, you have a Viet Dinh. He's a refugee from Vietnam who was a golden boy. He was identified early on, probably similar to Barry Sotoro. He was brought forward. He got into Harvard undergraduate. He went to Harvard Law School. He went to clerk for U.S. Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, and is in an academic position at Georgetown University the last time I checked. And he's the person that's credited widely with drafting the Patriot Act.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And I'm sure, you know, he probably comes from a right-wing family that were mercenaries for the U.S. government, and he's staunchly anti-communist, which is probably justified, but he probably in his heart of hearts thinks that he's helping protect the American people.
Yeah, exactly.
This is a dangerous thought that a lot of immigrant or children from immigrants other immigrants have, and I teach them, and that's one of the primary lessons I have to say. I said, listen, there are deeper forces at work here that you need to understand.
Well, see, that's been my point for a long time here as well, getting into some of these topics that I'm seeing that it's used in people's naivety and appeal to not only the guilt factor, but also this idea that they, with a few simple words and appeal to that, no, this is the right thing to do kind of thing, they get manipulated in that aspect. And it's not smart because they're thinking solely, well, they're not thinking, they just have an emotional attitude towards these questions as opposed to a rational one where you use your head and kind of see how it's being used. I think it's even worse and detrimental that over the factor that we see that it's being used and all of this talk, the language that's being used, is just there to kind of fluff people into a false sense of security, that they're part of something bigger and greater kind of thing, right?
Yes, it's classical mind control and groupthink. It's been studied extensively. And the big difference here is that the mind managers have been able to figure out how to use race, ethnicity, and now gender and factor it into the mix to control people and to have them engage in activities and behavior that is ultimately self-destructive, which is ironic.
Well, exactly. And this has to be one of the most difficult thresholds, if I can call it that, to actually pass over to or have the self-examination for this, because these are personal issues, right? This is a question of your own self-identification, so that you couldn't strike at any more personal level of critique. So this is something that people are going to take personal, therefore they're going to defend it from that personal level no matter what. And it's increasingly difficult then to kind of have an outside view of these subjects, correct?
That's exactly right. It's personal, it's existential. There's no amount, I hold out hope, but it's very difficult to reason, to provide documentation, to lay out the theoretical, the historical basis for their own self-delusion, because you are dealing really with irrationality. You're dealing with existential issues that are really difficult to disentangle from rational ones. And as I mentioned earlier about my own progress, it took me a while, and it took me a great deal of self-scrutiny and honesty to make a break from my own programming, through my own writing, through my previous work, my published work. People are probably going to ask, what happened to you? You know, what overcame you? And my response to that, I haven't really framed a response, but reality overcame me. And I'm trying to present the truths that I have studied consistently since 2005. And this is the result of it.
Now, there's another sentiment echoed in this as well. Maybe we can get into that a little bit. It was a while a news story came out, but I think it was one of a former Tory MP over in England who mentioned that immigrants are better citizens than the native British. It was one of the government advisors who said this. And I think as well, it had to do with something you touched upon earlier that has to do with the unquestioning obedience, I guess, to the state. Because as an immigrant, you, of course, want to do well. You want to be liked, right? That's, I would say, the majority of the cases anyway. And people are, they want to try to get into a system as opposed to, let's say, maybe a multi-generational family that's been in the country. They can have a more critical look. They want to maybe even to a certain extent get out of the system of the national government, as they can see more technologies coming into place, more spying, surveillance, the war industry in the case of America, let's say. So that's a really important dynamic and another point of why potentially we see also so huge numbers of the mass immigration into the Western world, correct?
Yeah, I think that's part of the strategy amongst the people who are advocating mass immigration. Is because your immigrant and refugee populations are going to keep their head down. They're going to try to sustain themselves and their families through finance, through the economic participation at the exclusion of almost everything else. And they will use, and this is a time-tested strategy, they'll use their ethnicity as a form of comfort, of support, of financial solidity. You know, ethnic economies are a feature of human civilization, age old, right?
Yeah.
This is nothing new. But at the same time, as you point out, what's happening is that the dark history, the deep history, is being made with their complicity, because they're just looking one step ahead of them rather than understanding the larger scope of things. And that's where I come in as an educator. So I'm saying this is really, I'm widening the frame here. I'm showing you that this is what you're being led into, and it's a dead end. You're not going to be able to get over if that doesn't exist anymore. Maybe a few like Dr. David Ho, who was recruited for these AIDS research projects, and select individuals are put up there for your inspiration, but you're not going to be part of that group. These people have already been tapped and selected at an early age. They're just there for promotional purposes. They'll get paid. They'll get some of the goodies, but for the most part, it's not going to happen for you. And it's very difficult to get that message across to your average 18 or 19-year-old, because understandably so, they romanticize the world, and they're idealistic, and they're charging ahead, which is good. That's all well and good, but I feel like I need to, as someone who's been there, to warn them of the pitfalls ahead.
Absolutely. Yeah, definitely. This is that's why I really enjoy your reading your book, of this kind of you share that revelation along the way, if you will. And this is a kind of parochialism, or a myopic outlook, if you will. So you mentioned education, but how do you suggest to bring up this question without people basically just kind of shutting the door in your face because of the emotional issues that are involved? How can this issue be discussed when I've noticed it myself, as soon as I bring up a critique of mass immigration, I get branded being a racist right away. And this is not a rational approach to the subject, because it's not about that question. It's about a much deeper political issue. It's about things that I see happening, to the culture, and the points that you brought up as well, that you see the kind of the building of a global state on top of all this, and people are not prone to see it. So how do we break through that?
Well, what will have to happen is they're going to have to be more people that are going to step forward and tell the truth and recant their mistakes, unintentional or so, such as myself, and be honest about the impact. I'm speaking of the U.S. situation here more specifically. Be honest of the impact of unbridled immigration. I was just speaking with a friend and colleague of mine of long standing. I've known him for 20 years. He happens to be of Mexican-American origins and an authority in his particular field. And he, at an honest level, said he's against mass immigration from Mexico. He's against, in the U.S., we have something that's being put out there called the DREAM Act, which is to allow the children of illegal immigrants education at the same rate as people who are native-born. He's against it. He feels that they should stay in Mexico and fight for a Republican form of government, democracy there,
right,
instead of exporting the political problems to the United States, which, as you know, is part of the globalist plan for implosion, as well as to create cultural fissures and conflicts.
Exactly.
And also to prepare the United States of America for political economic merging with Mexico, with the North American Union. You'll have a pre-existing base of people here that will welcome it, who are also overwhelmingly favorably disposed to the welfare system, the Democratic Party, their clients, their ready-made client base. And immigrants have been used in the United States for that purpose, Irish, Jews, even Asians, who are overwhelming Democrat as a power base like this. So to answer your question, there have to be, and there will be, I'm maybe one of the first, but there will be more people in academia who are attached to so-called reputable institutions like the University of California. And people are going to have to listen. Hey, this guy's not a crackpot. I mean, he's been there for 20 years. He's a full professor. We can talk in the second part what the repercussions are.
Sure.
Not getting away with it, by the way. The administration does not want to hear this. But right now, I'm winning one by one. The understanding of my colleagues, because they're living in this world, their futures are being subverted. They have children. They're facing the same problems that I've been laying out here, and they're beginning to come around slowly. So I'm optimistic that information, knowledge, and writing, and conversation, and intellectual inquiry will have an impact. But hopefully it'll be sooner than later, because the process is accelerating. It's just steaming down this trajectory that doesn't look really good for the United States of America and really the world.
Exactly. And I guess as well, what I find interesting with your work is that you do tie together with the technological aspect. You bring up people like Ray Kurzweil, the transhumanist issue and everything else, that this is almost like it's a window of time here before potentially the system of the very digitized, robotic system, artificial intelligence, et cetera, is in place before potentially the even human beings will be replaced to uphold this very system, right?
That's true. Nanotechnology, AI, you name it, GMOs, which the University of California, Davis is one of the top sites of that. That's going to, bodes ill for all of humanity, not just Asian Americans. Whatever group they want to put in there, you can substitute whatever group that they're being used as an intellectual workforce to bring about this new future that they envision. I'm using Kurzweil as emblematic of a number of people who think along the same lines as him. A future where there's no humanity, right? There are no human beings. It's a radical population reduction, including bright, intelligent people with university degrees. They're not part of the plan. And this is what my colleagues don't understand. I said, how can this happen? I'm smart. They need me. And I said, I'm sorry, that's a mistaken assumption. They don't need you.
Exactly. Well, we spoke, it's a recent show we got up there, but with Zoltan Istvan, he's a former journalist with the National Geographic, a pro-transhumanist, and I urge anyone who haven't yet listened to that program do so, because that is very interesting and very indicative as well, actually, of I would say, some of the thoughts, ideology, ideas that is part of that, and showing just the integration with the depopulation ideas and everything else, the population control as well. But let's touch upon a couple of more things here before we wrap things up with the first segment. We have much more to talk about. I want to get into more on the University of California, Davis in the second, of course. But you mentioned as well that there's kind of these waves of issues that are, they're being used as weapons, basically, and they're being used in such a way so that it's increasingly difficult to criticize them. But tell us a little bit about the LGBT community as well, and what you see as a phase in that strategy.
Mm-hmm. Well, the LGBT, the weaponized version, the government weaponized version of it, is an outgrowth of a genuine, authentic, grassroots, organic, if you will, social movement that began on the heels of the American Civil Rights period in the 1950s, but it really got underway through the late 60s and 1970s. And again, as in the case of race, the mind managers and the social engineers figured out that there are ways that we can use this legitimate dissent and turn it in our direction, right? Use it for our purposes. So they created certain crises. I won't get into the specifics of it. I'm sure your listeners have their own take on it. Crises like AIDS, so-called, to mobilize people around a joint terror, a joint threat. Or homophobia, right, which is true, it's real, but there are these media campaigns every once in a while picking certain people out, showing them the reality of homophobia. And then there's the massive infusion of money to academic institution to educate and train a whole new generation of young people, the same group that I'm trying to reach through my New World Order theory. They're trying to train them because these are the future professionals for the University of California. We produce the lawyers, the doctors, and the legislators and so forth for the California of the future. They're training them into this particular model of control. And in addition to this, I do have some documentation on this, and I have to admit that some of this is speculative at this point, but I'll put it out there anyway. In addition to this, because I've been teaching 30 years, so I've observed this. I haven't been able to quantify it, but I have observed this anecdotally. But in addition to this, there are chemical vectors out there that are being put out into the general population that is creating feminized men and hyper-feminized women. I've seen this. In addition to that, they're getting ideological programming. In addition to physiological rejiggering. They call it sexual dysmorphia. I have friends who are pediatricians and are telling me that they're seeing more and more young people, children or adolescents who suffer from gender ambiguity. These are all processes that have been documented by specialists, by medical scientists, as well in the social sciences and the humanities. The University of California, I think starting around the 1970s, there was something called theory, which is primary literary theory, and this is where queer theory, GLBT query, transgender theory started hitting the general education curriculum really, really hard. And there are a huge portion of the student body that don't subscribe to it, don't agree with it, but it is the reigning type of general education training at not just Research One institution like University of California, but most liberal arts colleges have them. It goes under the banner typically of women and gender studies. And gender studies is a code word for GLBT. It's heavily funded. Someone needs to do some forensic analysis to see where the money's coming from, who's supporting it, who's subsidizing it. And then we can start answering questions on why this is a desideratum in contemporary post-capitalist society, the whole GLBT worldview. I think it's not a matter of transgenderism. I think it's a matter of post-genderism, because in the future society, there will be no need for reproduction. There will be no need for genders. There will be no need for distinctions between man or woman. And at the outer extremes of this, we're seeing the boundaries between adult and child is being abolished and obliterated or made blurry, such as these pedophilia scandals that have been coming to the surface recently, most recently in Hollywood. I think part of that is not just to expose the criminality, but part of that agenda is to normalize it. If you hear of crimes often enough, it becomes almost a social norm. So there's a whole range of strategies that are coming on the foot of the racial, ethnic strategy that I have just critiqued in this book, and maybe the next project I should undertake should deal specifically with the GLBT agenda at the university.
Oh boy, I mean, I could just talk about this particular aspect for a long time. I mean, I can just reiterate some of the Swedish studies that have been done out of the, I think it was the University of Stockholm, possibly Gothenburg, but it showed primarily was about the sexual development of the fetus in the womb and the brain as well. This is the one key component that this had actually the most to do with the behavior and lifestyle of the mother. As far as this study was concerned, it related to, for example, chemicals such as phthalates, bisphenol A, and how these estrogen mimicking chemicals, what kind of effect they have on the endocrine system and consequently the brain development. And
that's exactly it. Yes.
This has everything to do with it, and unfortunately, we're in a situation now where the chemical, the ubiquitous chemical that exists within almost all over the world, of course, in lesser developed countries, this is going to be lessened, which is of course something that works to their advantage. in this case, but down to the very clothes that you wear on your body with the polyester and everything else, that all of this affects us and actually create this kind of dysmorphia that you talked about and this kind of confusion on top of it. So I feel very much that it's a sad state of things, of course, when there is an issue here of a kind of a chemical poisoning basically going on of mankind, and when this is not being recognized. It's actually the opposite, is being lifted up as something to praise, which I see is very, very interesting, you know?
Yeah, there's institutional site at most universities in the U.S. are so-called student services. And instead of addressing the problem with the chemical reengineering of humanity, they're making allowances for it. So instead of saying, okay, the BPH and the endocrine disruptors that are being put into our food and our packaging and our clothing and almost every ordinary household object, instead of addressing that, we're going to make allowances for your GLBT identity, whatever it might be. Wear a rainbow headband or whatever it might be. Or I noticed the United Auto Workers, now that they've succeeded in exporting most high-value, high-wage, high-salary, high-benefit jobs overseas to places like India and China, are now targeting students as their new client base. And a subset within that is the GLBT community. And one of their, this is serious, one of their demands is to have gender-free restrooms. So this is what we're going to be seeing at public facilities, I predict, if this agenda is taken further. And this is going to be, this is where New World Order kicks in here, is that some people say this is an accident, this needs to be corrected, we need to take the BPA out of the packaging and so forth. My theoretical perspective says this is intentional. This is part of the larger globalist control agenda.
That's right. Because the studies have been done and they know what effects they have. I mean, this is way, way, way back when they were developed in the early stages. They knew that there were even certain reversals of the estrogen mimicking chemicals that they did at the time. But no, there's been no recognition. And again, it's not that it's out of science. It's in there in the scientific documents. If you actually read it, it's again, what you said before, it's the non-connecting of these dots that is the issue, not the scientific studies themselves.
And then there are social institutions such as the university, like I say, they're expanding them by leaps and bounds. The biggest area of growth at the University of California is in student services. And most of it is to accommodate this huge expanding population of transgendered or ambiguously gendered or gender confused undergraduates. We're seeing the first wave of the generation of young people that have been biologically re-engineered into this. And that is part of this larger post-gender world that people like, well, I don't know if Kurzweil has addressed this specifically, but people on his level have already conceived of.
I know that he has this digital alter ego persona called Ramona that he sings songs with and everything else. He connects his stuff into a computer and plays a lady for a while, so I don't know what that's about, but there you go. Well, this is very interesting. Let's take a break in a little bit here, but before we do that, let's give out some websites, and again, of course, reiterating the title of the book that we've been talking about here so far, Servitors of the Empire, Studies in the Dark Side of Asian America. Tell us more where people can pick up copies of this book, Daryl.
That is at the fine independent publisher up in the state of Oregon on the west coast of the United States called Trine Day Books, capital T-R-I-N, capital D-A-Y, one word. If you just type that in, you'll be able to get to their website. You've had a number of their authors on Red Eyes Creations Radio, and I'm really proud to be listed as an author and one of my favorite publishers, Trine Day. You might also look at a website called Fight the Tower. It's a play on the Public Enemy song, Fight the Power. It's Fight the Tower, which means the ivory tower. This is a site that's maintained by a friend and colleague of mine named Professor Kulin Balverde that talks about some of the inner workings of the modern UC and where we're going with this, because they're also attacking faculty, by the way, which will be we can talk about presently. So you could look at Fight the Tower, and The third, you might just look at the University of California general website, because it's a really, really important international global institution where these agenda are being played out. They're being researched, they're being played out. It's a microcosm of really new world order. So I'm really thankful that I'm in the belly of the beast, so to speak.
We have someone behind enemy lines, as it were, yeah.
Could be. I don't know how long I'm going to be able to dodge their attacks, but I'll give it a try.
Oh, boy. Well, we'll definitely speak more about that in the second then, Daryl, and pick up there. In the meantime, trineday.com, fightthetower.com, and also, of course, universityofcalifornia.edu. That's the website. We'll have those linked up on redicecreations.com and redicemembers.com. But we'll pick this up after the break. Stay with us, Daryl. Very interesting. We'll continue shortly. We will pick this up right after the break and continue to speak more with Daryl Hamamoto and his experiences as a professor teaching at the University of California. We talk about political correctness, the various weaponized interest groups, identity politics, and New World Order theory. We speak more about cultural Marxism in the university environment and where the students themselves stand on some of these issues. And Daryl paints a far more positive view on where most students are than I would have expected. Hamamoto also talks about the Mondavi International Wine Mafia and the House of Rothschild connection to the University of California. Before we proceed, our next program is with Mikkel Clare Nissen from Denmark with a perspective on Danish society and a critical view on the much-celebrated collectivist model. We'll speak more on the psychology behind the control, an analysis of the arrested development that the majority of the grown-ups in the Scandinavian countries suffer from, an ailment brought on by state education and indoctrination. All right, we'll pick up at redicemembers.com now with Daryl Hamamoto. Subscribe to catch the second hour. And of course, if you enjoy the program and want to stream or download all our previous shows, please go over to redicemembers.com, sign up for a membership, and we'll see you there. Thank you for listening.